You're listening to Adopter Stories on the Adoption and Fostering Podcast. In this episode, Gary and Kyle share their story of fostering, then adopting children with complex needs.
We, being a same-sex couple, had lots of friends at parties or when we were meeting that said, "Oh, we'll be a surrogate for you." And that was never really an avenue that we wanted to go down.
I think other people were keener on that than us, weren't they, really?
Yeah.
It seemed that they wanted to help us, genuinely wanted to help us.
Yep.
But it was also a bit of a fad, maybe, that I will have a baby for you without actually thinking
or asking us what we wanted.
You know, about all of the implications of what that would actually mean, you know, being a surrogate for us. So we discounted that very early on, didn't we?
Yeah, and it was just a case of we knew that we were going to have a family and wanted a family. We just weren't too sure how we were going to go about it. But adoption seemed the route that we would eventually go down.
And we didn't start with adoption, did we? We started with fostering. And we didn't really even start with fostering. It was almost accidental that Hayden, our first son, came to be in our lives. And it wasn't a conscious decision that, right, we're going to start the fostering journey or we're going to start the adoption journey. I just happened to be sitting in our town. I opened the newspaper and there was an advert for a little boy who was looking for his forever home. And I was on my own. Kyle was at work. I was doing something else. It was probably a weekend, I don't know. This little boy jumped off the page to us. I can't even remember the name that they used. You know, Jack is looking for a mum and dad who can cook roast dinners, that have a car, and that can be his forever family.
And he likes sausages.
And he likes sausages. And, you know, apart from the mum and dad bit, I thought that it may have been a good one for us to pursue. And I don't know what it was about the advert. It was really well written. And I did know more. I picked up the phone and made that initial inquiry.
And then phoned me to tell me that you'd phoned.
Yeah.
So. Things happened at the right time for the right reason. So Gary wasn't supposed to be home that day. Gary wasn't supposed to have picked up the newspaper because we never bought that newspaper, and he did. And it just seemed to be that everything slotted in and everything seemed to be going in the right direction at the right place at the right time for the right thing.
And after that initial phone call, the first stages happened really quickly. I think we had two social workers at our door within the week. Mm. The older of the two social workers arrived on her bike with
the basket on the front.
Yeah, with a basket on the front and a bell. And she was she was our real advocate, wasn't she?
She was proper old school social worker who wrote everything in biro, typed nothing up.
Had lots of common sense. Yeah, became a friend of ours through the journey. And then the other social worker, we developed a real respect for her, but also she was the quirkiest, most ungiving individual.
Yeah. Like, we knew nothing of her from the start of our journey with her to our end of our journey with her. Which must have been 5 years. We just knew her name and that was it. But she was an amazing social worker for Hayden. Because he got everything he should ever need and ever want, and she fought his corner, but she gave no more than that. That was it, completely closed off. Whereas our social worker, you knew the ins and outs of her life.
Her marriage.
Her marriage, where's on holiday, her kids, her grandkids, what car she was thinking of buying, why she was thinking of buying it. They couldn't have been two polar opposites, which was really interesting to start your journey with two very, 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 very different people supporting you.
And I think we found it a real challenge because we as a couple were more like our social worker, and not being able to read somebody and not being able to engage with them on a personal level was really difficult for us. And even up until the day of the adoption panel, we didn't know whether this social worker wanted us to have Hayden. We didn't really know whether she approved of us as a couple. We knew nothing. And maybe there was something for us about us needing approval. I don't know. But that was the start of our journey. Very early on, our social worker, she told us that we would be the first male single-sex couple to foster for the local authority. And so she wanted us to be her retirement swan song to finish on a high. She felt that we would be the best possible match for Hayden. And so she was going to do everything in her power to make sure that that happened. And so that's where it started.
Yep. because Hayden was six. He is 16 this year, but when he came to us, he was 6 years old.
And Hayden has cerebral palsy.
And Hayden has additional needs. So he's a full-time wheelchair user, partially sighted in one eye. He has the partial use of one hand. He has the full use of his mouth, which as an opinionated 15-year-old, we are knowing a lot of. But when he came as a six-year-old, he was very vulnerable. And we wanted to do the best that we could for him to sort of shield him from all sort of like the negativity around disability, and we wanted to be there for him. But at the same time, we wanted to expose him to as much of the world as possible, because he'd led quite a sheltered life.
Dull life.
And it was dull. You know, we wanted to sort of get him out there and show him the colours of the world that were out there and all these amazing things that are out there. And so for us, it was a sharp learning curve of slow and steady wins the race, and we're not going to change the world overnight.
It wasn't just us and the dog anymore. There was this other human in the house, which obviously you think about and you talk about constantly when you're going through the fostering or adoption process. You talk about how your life is going to change, and no one has a clue.
Not a clue.
Not so you've got to balance that with actually getting to know Hayden with all of the issues and trauma that comes with a child that is within the care system. And, you know, I talk to friends and colleagues a lot about the fact that anyone thinking of adopting or fostering, their first understanding needs to be there's no fairy tale at the beginning. You know, there's no you know, sweeping each other up into their arms and everything's going to be rosy from day one.
They're skipping off into the sunset in the first week.
You know, and we did think that for a while, I think.
Oh, yeah, completely deluded.
We thought we were going to fix Hayden within a week and he would be a happy, well-balanced, untroubled little boy, where in actual fact, in the first 6 months, he tested us to the edge of our relationship and really made us question whether we'd done the right thing. And it was because he was testing us, every fiber of your being, to make sure you were the real deal.
And things were gonna, the one thing that we learned quite quickly is, yes, Hayden was testing us, but also it was him taking control of, I'm gonna make this fail, because then I'm in control of when it fails. So I'm going to make this stop rather than you stopping it for me, because I don't know when that's going to be. So because Hayden was told that we are his forever family, that's it. No more fostering, no more going off anywhere to other families. This is it. He was testing what he was told, to make sure that actually, if I push these boundaries, are you still going to keep? And it was, I mean, it took probably, I would say, 5 years for him to settle down.
Yeah, fully.
5 years.
The day the social worker told him that he'd been found a forever family, and she only told us this later, but his first reaction was to slap her around the face. I don't think he believed it, and he was just testing her even to make sure that she was telling him the truth. In that 5 years that Kyle's just said that he was testing us, there are amazing times and pure joy and an absolute deep sense of love, but there were some really tough days. In the early days, Hayden still went for respite because he's a disabled child, which means he was eligible for some time away from us and us some time away from him. And I remember us walking along Deal Beach and almost being scared to say to each other, have we done the right thing? Because are we able to actually meet his needs? You know, there's probably an arrogance with us that because of our backgrounds, Kyle was in social care as well. I was a head teacher.
I worked in social care.
Yeah, sorry. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Not in
I wasn't in care.
No.
I worked in social care. There's quite a big difference.
Kyle worked in social care. I was a head teacher, and there was probably an arrogance that we were the ideal match on paper for this little boy because of our backgrounds. Why weren't we coping as well as we could? And we walked along Deal Beach and actually said to each other, have we done the right thing? And actually, I think if we hadn't had that conversation, we probably wouldn't have coped with it as well as we did. And he tested Kyle much more than me. And I think that was because Kyle was at home with Hayden more than me, because I worked quite a way away.
And I'm the stay-at-home dad.
And you were the stay-at-home dad at that point. And he developed a really close relationship with you, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he either absolutely depended on you and loved you and adored you, or hated you.
Or loathed me.
Yeah. And would be violent and vile.
And then Gary would walk in through the door. So I'd pick Hayden up from school at 3:00. And as soon as I picked him up, he'd start screaming, shouting, hitting himself, making himself sick. All these things to test me. And as soon as Gary walked in through the door at 7:00, it was like, Gary, you're home. How are you? And he would switch from one way of behavior with me and then, Daddy, you're home, to Gary as soon as Gary walked in through the door, which is another way of sort of testing us, you know, and testing our relationship. And, you know, that's how we coped with it.
I mean, we laugh now. And if Hayden's having a grumpy teenage day now, I'll say to him, oh, Hayden, do you want a new family? Shall I call your social worker? Because that's all he used to say, you know, was, I want a new family. Send me back. Phone my social worker. Because he thought that would be hurtful for us. Not because that's what he wanted.
And Hayden, even now, if he's on his phone, I'm like, who are you talking to? He's like, and it'd be a friend from school. And he's like, I'm just on the phone to my social worker, seeing if they can find me another family. And he's like, oh, good luck with that. He just sits there laughing and then goes, no, it's all right. It's just my dad. No, I was just mucking around with him as I'm leaving his bedroom. So there is a good sense of humour in him. We were okayed by social services to foster Hayden and do respite for others.
But we were only registered
for boys.
For boys.
Because how on earth would two men cope with the care of girls?
And we were only registered for boys 5 to 16, weren't we?
Yeah. And a phone call on a Wednesday afternoon saying, it's looking for respite. And I'm like, okay, how little? Well, he's 12 weeks old. He has cerebral palsy. He has this condition. He has this condition. He has that. And they basically just reeled off a list of conditions. And my initial reaction was, oh, you must be really scraping the barrel if you phoned us up, because one, he's a baby. Two, he's 12 weeks old and not our remit. So I'm assuming everybody else has said no.
And you're going to have to change our registration.
And they were like, well, don't worry about your registration. We can sort that out. I said, well, okay. I said, well, I can't say yes because I need to meet him. I said, I can't really say we can meet this child's needs just by you ruling off a list of diagnoses. So I went to meet Curtis, who was this 12-week-old baby. And I was like, yeah, he'll fit in fine. We can meet all of his needs, I'm sure. If there's any problems, there's community nursing. There's the hospital that we had close links with. It'll be fine. He came for a weekend for respite. And then he came for a bit longer for respite. And then he came for a bit longer. And then it got longer and longer and longer. And then we were sort of having him every weekend and doing some sort of like shared care with another foster family. And that really wasn't working for us and it wasn't working for them. It gave them the rests that they needed at the weekend, but it really didn't help us because we were just a stopgap, had him, got him sorted and then sent him back again. So we were asked if we would have him full time while social services looked for a permanent adoptive family.
But there was an added issue that Curtis wasn't expected to live past his first birthday. So they didn't want to put too many plans in place because they could go to all that time and trouble of matching and then one chest infection and he wouldn't be here anymore. There's a good end to that story. You know, he was 12 weeks when he came to us. He's 8 now, you know. but he came, and so then we were fostering 2 boys, but we'd already started the conversation about adopting Hayden because it was clear he was going to be in our forever home. You know, we were going to be his forever family, and the time was right to start the adoption process. So we raised the question quite early on, why don't we just adopt both boys? So bearing in mind, our local authority was fairly... well, very new to single-sex fostering, for males especially. Then we'd got this little boy, Hayden. Then we got this other boy, Curtis. And then we're asking to adopt them, but both at the same time. And it nearly blew social services' minds that we were going to try to go through the adoption process with 2 children who were not biologically linked at the same time, in the same court with the same social workers. They just saw no way of doing that.
And it was almost like there was this mental block of like, it just can't happen. Computer said, no, it can't happen. But the problem is Curtis was almost 2 at this point. So the boys had been living together from the age of Curtis being 12 weeks old to coming up to 2 years old. So it wasn't like they'd never met each other. It was the fact that they'd actually lived together for neon 2 years. Hayden saw himself as a big brother to Curtis. Curtis had known no different.
I'm going to be really honest and say that part of the push for us for adopting both the boys together, A, because it's, you know, good for family dynamics, it sends a really good message to both boys. But I think winding social services up became a bit of a sport, really, because we would ask them questions or we'd suggest things that they just had no flexibility in their response. So we wanted to take Hayden abroad, for example, to Spain in our first year of fostering him, didn't we?
Yeah.
And it was like, well, no, you can't do that. You know, we'd need a passport. Well, let's apply for one.
Let's get a passport.
you know, we want him to go rock climbing. But he's got cerebral palsy. He can't go rock climbing, you know. And so it went on and on.
Oh, canoeing.
Yeah.
We were like, oh, we're going on a family holiday and we're going canoeing. What's Hayden going to do?
He'll go canoeing.
But he's in a wheelchair. Well, we'll take him out of his wheelchair. But he'll be on water. What happens if he falls out of the canoe? Well, he'll get wet. Yeah, don't worry about it. He'll be fine. Like most kids his age, he'll have fun.
But this whole sort of adoption process, it did blow their minds, and we didn't stop pushing, and we said this needs to happen for these boys, and funnily enough, it happened. You know, it wasn't a problem for the judges, certainly.
We got a phone call from social services because we'd moved house. We'd adopted two boys. We were still open to fostering. You get the phone call. You've got two spare beds, and the social workers want them filled. So, you know, we got the phone call. We've got two boys coming into care today, age 10 and 13. Can you take them? It'll just be a short-term basis. And we're like, oh, yeah, of course. So we said yes. I phoned Gary and said, right, we've got two boys coming today. Had, you know, we'll get everything ready. Not a problem. We get home. There's a knock at the door. We open the door, and there's two social workers, a social work assistant, and an 18-month-old little girl, and a 6-year-old with Down syndrome little girl. And we're like, you've got the house. And they were like, oh no.
Can you help us?
And it's like, and we've bedroomed clothes because we've got nothing but small pink people. We've got everything for big blue people. Right, okay. So I just looked at Gary and went, you need to go to Tesco's and buy everything from the ages, I'd say, 13 months to 5 years. Keep the receipts, because what doesn't fit, we'll take back tomorrow. And literally, the social worker's like, well, you can't go now because we've got a complete paperwork. And we're like, we've got nothing for these kids. So Gary was like, I'll see you in an hour, and literally bought up the whole of Tesco's, and came home with high chairs and a cot and
just bags,
literally
clothes.
Everything, clothes, because the girls came with sort of clothes on their back and a bing bag full of clothes, and none of it was appropriate or fitted. It just wasn't right. So we had to start again that evening. And
they were, I mean, when we first met both boys, they'd already been in foster care. The first time we saw both of them, they were clean, they smelt nice. The girls walked through our door and they were filthy.
Shell-shocked.
And it was really traumatic because they had literally come into care on an emergency order that afternoon. Yeah, that afternoon. So it was a very, very different experience. And the experience was one of emergency, just taking care of these kids in a totally different way. We had to take shifts, didn't we, that first week?
Because it took 7 hours to settle them to bed every night. So we'd start settling for bed at sort of 7 o'clock, and we were still going at 2 a.m, of just getting the girls back into bed. They'd get up, go back to bed. We'd get them up, they'd put them back to bed. It was like the super nanny stuff. You know, when there's super nanny stood on the hallway in the landing, a child gets out of bed, super nanny walks in, puts the child back to bed. And within like a 30-second segment of an hour show, she's cured that child of all of his problems of getting up and out of bed. Reality is, it was 7 hours a night for a good couple of weeks. And we were like, oh, we've done all right tonight. Only 5 hours. That's good going. We're getting there. There's progress.
But there was what was amazing with those girls, and just how resilient they are and how amazing they are, is their turnaround from being these traumatized little things that didn't even know their name to being really well functioning princesses was really quick, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and
there's a real tight bond between the two girls.
Yeah.
Because there was an idea, there was a comment that was made at a meeting that the idea was to split the girls up. Because Phoebe had more chance of being adopted on her own without Isabella, and Isabella had more chance of being adopted if she stayed with Phoebe. And we couldn't allow either girl to be split up. So we said, actually, we want our name to be thrown in the hat and we'll adopt the girls.
Well, you can imagine. So we'd blown their mind by being the first male couple in our local authority. We'd then blown their mind by wanting to adopt two unrelated boys together. Now we wanted to adopt two more kids. And they were girls. And well, you know, this has just not been done. You know, this was like blowing their mind. We wanted to adopt them, and then there was a problem.
How would you cope?
How would we cope? What capacity have you got? How will you deal with girls' issues as they get older?
But, you know, we've got grandmothers, we've got neighbours, we've got sisters, we've got aunties, we've got cousins, you know, they'll have friends their own. There's all these sort of, you know, there are positive female role models in our lives, they just don't live in our house.
And our social worker, the one that originally came to our house on her bike on that first day, was still around, and she was still saying to us, no, you're right. These girls need to stay with you. They need to be with you. And everyone else around us was questioning us and saying, have you got the capacity? And at that point, we just said, no. Either you've made an assessment that we're good enough to foster these kids and therefore we're going to be good enough to adopt them, or we're just not good enough. So, you know, bye-bye, nice, independent social worker man. Let's speak to the girl social workers and our social worker, and we need to say, sorry, you know, that's it. You make a decision, either we're good enough or we're not. And it was very quickly agreed that we were good enough.
Yeah, and I think what what also helped was the fact that because of our experiences with the boys and because of their disabilities and the respect that we'd got with the health professionals through supporting the boys and the milestones that the boys were making, when it's because of Isabella's Down syndrome and her global delay and all the other little bits that were attached to her at the time, they were seeing some of the same professionals. So we were seeing the same people, but rather than seeing them for the boys, we were seeing them for the girls. And the girls and the professionals are going, well, you know, these girls have they've never formed an attachment. The only attachment that they've ever really made is to you and Gary. Now, if that attachment is suddenly broken, they may never form meaningful attachments again. So we had health professionals that were also supporting us in the adoption of the girls.
The other thing that happened, which gave me actually, I don't know, a respect for their birth parents. I don't know what it was, but the birth parents wrote to the judge and said to the judge that we are not going to contest the adoption. We're not going to appeal it if Gary and Kyle become the adoptive parents. But if they're moved or if there's any other,
any other
change,
family,
we won't stop fighting. And whether they had any power or not, and whether they had any influence or not, wasn't the point. The point was that there were these parents that had, lost their children. No matter what happened, actually, with the girls, they were still loved, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know, mum and dad absolutely loved them to bits. And to have that was quite special in a way, wasn't it?
Yeah, because they didn't need to do that, but they did.
And there could have been hate and resentment, and there wasn't, you know. No. There was this affirmation that actually, if the girls are going to be adopted, it needs to be with those two boys.
Yeah. And that's how we ended up with four. I gave up work and became a at-home dad. Suddenly, you're on your own for pretty much a large portion of the day, which means that when you've been speaking to a two-year-old all day, you know, as in my case for Curtis, because he's non-verbal, I talk at him a lot. It just means that when Gary walks in through the door at 6:30, I bombard him completely with conversation about the most boring, trivial things, and I expect undivided attention because I've had nobody else to speak to all day.
But you've also found it a massive challenge on a different level, haven't you, in terms of your purpose is solely the children.
Yeah.
But you're also a really successful professional, and that was almost
when we started, I was managing the kids' home. You know, at the time of when Gary and I met, Gary was the youngest head teacher in Kent, and I was the youngest registered children's manager in Kent. And then the two of us get together, we're going to change the world. And suddenly I've gone from sort of having 50 odd kids that I'm responsible for with numerous amounts of staff to me and a 12-week-old baby that just needs my undivided attention. And that's it. And that's a huge shift, if I'm honest, for me. And it took a little bit of time to sort of settle into the new role of just being dad.
Just.
Well, you know what I mean. There's a difference between sort of being responsible and the busyness, I think it was, of work. And the fact that at work, you could leave work and go home. Whereas when you are a parent, and you'll become instantly a parent to a six-year-old, there is no turning off from that. There is no walking away from that, because your six-year-old is always going to be there. They're just going to get bigger and older. I think that was one of the biggest shifts for me from working life to just being, to being a stay-at-home dad.
I found two things really difficult, two things really challenging that I don't think have ever gone away since the day Curtis moved in and since the day Hayden had quite a big seizure, which was probably, a year into us being with us. I was terrified that, I'm still terrified that Curtis is going to die because he's really a complex little boy. And I don't have the, I have 100th, maybe 1,000th of the skill that Kyle has in caring for Curtis's health needs. And that's a big, and I think that level of fear, is it fear? I don't know. Or just that constant feeling, I would imagine many, many adoptive parents of children with disabilities feel, because these children have an added level of vulnerability that they don't only have the trauma of going into care or being adopted, but they also have
life-limiting
conditions as well, which is really, really tricky. But even worse than that, my biggest challenge, which has been, again, from day one, is how the education system works without it. I guess I'm fairly good at my job, and it made me see my profession in a totally different light, where there were amazing examples of brilliant partnership working, great advocates for kids in school, and then some really dreadful examples of how not to work with kids who are adopted or in care or those with disabilities. And I found it really, the biggest challenge with me was not making a fool of myself by reacting in an angry or aggressive way, because it angered me so much. Mm. And we've been in some dreadful situations with our kids, you know, and I'm a massive advocate for primary education, to see how sometimes our kids have been treated in education has been disgusting, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's the biggest challenge for me, because I'm in that profession, and that is a real problem for me.
Well, the high points are the kids. You know, they're not the people that walked in through the door. We have raised 4 confident, self-opinionated, challenging in a positive way. Woe betide anybody that taps Hayden on the head and says, oh, lovely, they're there, because they will be told, don't touch me, don't pat me on the head, I'm not a dog. Which, you know, you want in your son who is in a wheelchair and is a full-time wheelchair user. You want him to be confident to challenge people that have a preconception because he's in a wheelchair and looks a little bit different, perhaps. But you also want siblings to grow up as brother and sister. And they argue like cat and dog. You know, and if anybody walked in, anybody would think that they are biological brothers and sisters because they argue like cat and dog, but they will stick up for each other. I think, and they are there for each other. And I think, you know, that makes us realize that we're doing our job right. As parents, and you know, they're enjoying school and life.
There's a few highlights for me, or a few highs. The first one was when Hayden changed schools, he was chosen to be the star part in the play. And this was a little boy who, when we met him when he was 6, was really difficult to understand. Smiled a lot but had no confidence. And then 4 years later, he's Big Bad Ben in the Christmas play. And I took the morning off work and made sure I was there to see it. And that was amazing. The next high for me was we've got a little video on our phone and photos of Phoebe, probably when she was 5 or 6, interacting with Curtis, and Curtis is really quite passive, so he can't move his body. And Phoebe had got some slime and was manipulating Curtis's hand in the slime. And she was just so caring and so beautiful. And Curtis was looking directly at Phoebe and smiling. And Phoebe didn't know anyone was watching. And that for me was a real high that we'd got it right with her, and that she absolutely loved her little brother, or her big brother.
It's her big brother.
Yeah, her big brother.
She's the youngest.
And that was I still think about that all the time. But then there's highs in different ways, and those highs are...
Yesterday. Isabella has speech and language difficulties, and she said something just quite flippantly in the bathroom, and we went, oh, she said the p sound, and there was me and Gary going p p p p p p p coming up the hallway because she'd made the sound, and it was just, you know, for anybody else it'd be quite a, oh yeah, you know, my daughter's just gone p for puzzle or whatever. But for us, we were chatting about it for a good half hour, quite animated that she made this puh sound. You know, she's 12 this month, and she's suddenly just been able to make this puh sound. There's big highs, but sort of, you know, for us, it could be for the fact that interacting with the brother or sister or making a puh sound when they're talking.
And the last high for me was... I mentioned before that we'd been on TV on DIY SOS, and after that we won an award for being advocates of gay adoption and gay fostering, and through the Attitude magazine. And when we were given our award, there was a quote read out from a national newspaper that isn't known for its liberalism, and it said, watching this program with this family has made us change our mind about gay adoption. And that was a big high for me.